So I invite you to listen to some challenging words from Jesus. Because these words are from Jesus, we tend to turn our IQs down about 37 points and just go, alrighty. If a stranger were saying these words to you, you'd be going, what? What? No, that's stupid. So be thinking, be scandalized, get angry, or you're not listening. Jesus didn't get crucified for being a nice guy. He got crucified for offending people in power and for turning upside down everyone's expectations about what a holy man is. So, yeah, if you're not getting at least a little weirded out, you're asleep. Also remember, the people listening to him now are his disciples, also just regular folk, and also members of the religious and political elite. And Jesus says to all of them, a disciple is not above the teacher, nor a slave above the master. It is enough for the disciple to be like the teacher, and the slave like the master. And then he gives them this warning. If they've called the master of the house Beelzebul, Lord of the flies, how much more will they malign those of his household? So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered up that will not be uncovered, and nothing secret that will not become known. What I say to you in the dark, tell in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim from the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear the one who can destroy both soul and body in Gehenna. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. And even the hairs of your head are all counted. So do not be afraid. You are of more value than many sparrows. Everyone, therefore, who acknowledges me before others, I also will acknowledge before my Father in heaven. But whoever denies me before others, I will also deny before my Father in heaven. Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have come not to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and one's foes will be members of one's own household. There's a paraphrase of it that I wrote in here, or included in here, from the Message. Don't think that I've come to make life cozy. I've come to cut, to make a sharp knife cut between son and father, daughter and mother, bride and mother-in-law. Cut through these cozy domestic arrangements and free you for God. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who find their life will lose it. And those who lose their life for my sake will find it. The last part's just a reiteration. My daughter Chloe made a homemade card for me for Father's Day. It's an abstract watercolor with an abstract peacock feather on it. And on the inside she wrote, "Happy Father's Day. Thank you for being the most kind, compassionate dad ever. I love you so much. Thanks for pumping up bike tires, vacuuming, helping me out all the time, and just always being there for me." This card kept me glowing for days. It was like, it was really wonderful. And then I'm planning ahead for this Sunday's worship, and I read, "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Jesus! I wish you hadn't said that. I mean, Jesus, I love you and all, dude, but my daughter made me a card for Father's Day. What did you make for me? And Jesus, exactly what good is it doing for anybody to say, whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me? Exactly what good is it doing to say about my family, or say to my family, I have not come to bring peace but a sword? I have come to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother. What happened to being the Prince of Peace? What happened to love and family values and all that stuff? What's going on here? I want to ask if you were there. I suspect the strong language is so brutal, because what is going on here is Jesus is asking, no, Jesus is demanding that we prioritize the important stuff in our lives, and doing it in a far more radical way than we are comfortable with. You can be a comfortable Christian in this culture without ever being challenged from the outside. I mean, we all have bad things happen. There is sickness, and there's disappointment, and there is death. But very few of us have bad things happen to us because we're Christian. But our culture is changing and looking more and more like the first century to which Jesus was speaking, and that may need to change. Right now, most of us deal with the gospel the same way we deal with those Apple software agreements that you get online, where there's like 800 pages of stuff, and you scan very quickly down to the bottom and then click, I agree, without any idea of what's there in the fine print. Well, Jesus isn't into fine print. He wants us to know exactly what following him entails so that we can make an informed decision about following. Now, y'all don't need a lecture on late first century sociology of Palestine, but suffice it to say that Jesus' dire warnings here were simply truth in advertising for following Jesus in the early church. If you grew up in a Jewish or Roman family in the year 60 or so, and you became a member of this group that called itself The Way, following this dead rabbi guy named Joshua, or Yeshua as he was pronounced then, this Yeshua guy could become an instrument that would split your family apart. A brother might report you to the temple authorities and have you kicked out of your local synagogue. A mother could report you to the Roman authorities and have you jailed and killed for not worshiping Caesar, for being an official atheist in the eyes of Rome. You met at night surreptitiously with other Christians to avoid arrest. But as Jesus said, what I say to you in the dark, tell in the light. And what you hear whispered, proclaim from the housetops. So in that first century context, if your allegiance to your family or to patriotism or to institutional religion was greater than your allegiance to Christ, you weren't going to be able to hack it. Jesus' dire warnings were the natural consequences of saying yes to the cost of discipleship. Authentic discipleship in the first century could cost you your reputation, your standing in the community, your family, even your life at the end of the first century. Saying yes to following him did not automatically bring peace. It did certainly not bring comfy family values. It brought a sword, a sharp blade of decision making. Having to ask yourself, what is going to be central in my life? Steve Garnes Holm wrote this about that sword. He wrote, "It's not a sword of conflict or violence. It's the cutting edge of making choices, splitting what you choose from what you don't choose, and making your choices set you apart from others, even friends, even family. This is the work of becoming your own self." Authentic discipleship can cause splits and friction today in ways big and little. We've heard of the little ways where, you know, your kid joins a denomination that's different from yours because she fell in love with a boy. But there's bigger risks than that. What if your daughter, because she follows Jesus, is the only person in school to defend and befriend a transgendered student who's being bullied? And that means now your daughter is going to be bullied too. Do you ask her to decide for safety or for love? What if your son, because he follows Jesus, is denied college financial aid because he becomes a conscientious objector? And now that's going to cost him and you a lot more tuition money to go to school. What if the person in the pew next to you, because they follow Jesus, gets arrested for protesting at a missile silo? What if your pastor, because he's trying to follow Jesus, gets caught transporting government confiscated computers bound for Methodist healthcare centers in Cuba? That's purely hypothetical, never happened. Situations like that make families look at what the important stuff is. And it makes communities and churches look at what the important stuff is. And sometimes that examining can split families and churches and communities apart. That is the sword. That is the no peace that Jesus warns about. That is the cost of saying yes to authentic discipleship. But discipleship is not just about pain and suffering. Although if you're getting it, it's a good sign. It is a sign of authentic discipleship. But it's also about living. It's about living without fear. It's about living in love. It's an invitation to a deeper relationship with other human beings and with God and with Jesus. Even in the midst of troubles, the troubles that Jesus promised his followers, Jesus also assured his disciples that God was the one with his eyes upon the sparrow, that God was the one who counted the very hairs on your head. This is where all pastors insert a joke about how much easier that is as our days go on. But we won't do that this morning. This is the God who promised that there was not a tear that would be shed that God would not wipe away. There's no joy that would be felt that God would not dance to. Christ, yes, calls us to our crosses. But as Paul writes in Romans, if we have been united with Christ in a death like Christ, then we will certainly be united with Christ in a resurrection like Christ. Such is the cost and the joy of discipleship. Retired Episcopal priest Barbara Brown Taylor writes that, while it may send a shiver down our spines, there is good news here for those with the nerve to hear it. The gospel, she writes, is not a flashlight. It is a fire. It can warm and it can burn. The gospel is not a butter knife, but it is a sword. It can set free and it can divide. The gospel is not pablum. It is powerful stuff, powerful enough to challenge the most sacred human ties, but as frightening as that is, it is not finally to be feared. It is to be loved. For ultimately, that is what the gospel is. Love. Just love. Someone asked the Methodist theologian Albert Outler what he had learned over a lifetime of being a United Methodist theologian and pastor. He responded, "Early in my life, I would tell people, you've got to love, you've got to love. Now I have grown to realize that you get to love. You get to love. That's the point. You don't have to give up family and friends and sunsets, all those favorite and important things, because we love God. It's entirely the other way around. Because we love God, we can love these important and favorite things even more, but we put them in the context they should be. Not the center, but the wonderful things that orbit with us around the love of God. Our lives become more real, more full, more worth living." Steve Garness Holmes again wrote about this reading, "Listen deeply to God. Let God alone lead you. Make yourself available to God as an instrument of righteousness, and know that even as you let go of life, you receive life." So I invite you this Sunday, as though for the first time, to say yes to discipleship, to say yes to Jesus, to say yes to love.